Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening.
You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. And then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Great.
Okay.
Good. Well, I was thinking it's been 6 years, just about. A little over 6 years since we last spoke. Certainly a lot of water's gone under my bridge. A lot of changing perspectives in that time. And from what I've gathered, you've been doing a whole lot of traveling in that time.
Yes, yes, I have. Traveling to Europe and Asia, mostly.
I think that's one definition of liminal. You're being very liminal because you're constantly in between places and states. And
sure. And there's this cultural dissonance that takes place when you're, you know, when you're obviously an American in a country that's obviously not, and you know, you're wandering in a kind of twilight zone where you think you know who you are, but the other people around you are projecting onto you different qualities, and you know, your identity becomes a composite of what you think you are and what they think you are, and then there's a composite identity which is created, you know, by two cultures basically, or two forms of consciousness, and it's interesting.
Mm. It's do you find that liberating?
It can be, or it can be restrictive. If I'm an American and I'm in a place where there's a lot of anti-American sentiment, I'm identified with you know, extreme right-wing political views, for instance. I'm identified with the invasion of foreign countries, or with policies with which I do not agree and which I have opposed. So it takes a bit of work to get past some of that.
I was going to say, it would take a while to set that record straight, it seems like. You have to read all of these books. I've got three trilogies.
You'll know. Well, it's sometimes easier just to say you're a Canadian.
Right. So I confess to feeling slightly more overwhelmed by the prospect of talking to you than I usually do doing this podcast. Part of it is that there's just so much to talk about. A difference between you and I is that you do a great deal of this deep background research, to the point that you actually seem to be involved in the narratives that you're exploring or uncovering. I mean, you have this uncanny knack. It seems to be in the right place at the right time, which is something we could definitely talk about, but I'll just finish what I was saying. And whereas I'm more of a contextualizer, I don't do a lot of research. My wife does a lot for me if I need it, if it seems like it's needed, but I tend to be trying to unify the material and to find or create a context, like a model, that will recontextualize all of that material. And currently liminality is the thing that I've found. I have this idea that it's a very wide or a very penetrating lens that if used rightly can recontextualize a great deal of material and give it coherence.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my hope in talking to you, is that I can sort of mine you for the information that you have, and we can see if we can bring some new kind of coherence to it.
Sure.
I'm going to go back to that point because I just think it is one that's really, I don't know if it's come up for you before, but I'll even say you seem to have a suspicious knack for being in the right places at the right time. And it does seem like your history, and you don't really write about your personal history, it seems very much, but you do include it in there, has allowed you to, up to the present, to really be as I said, in the right place at the right time, really be there very close to the center of the nexus of things as they're happening. I'm thinking the Berkovich and the Son of Sam, the bookshop you talked about where Lennon and Yoko Ono were hanging about. I just heard about, I think you mentioned on Stormy Weather, how you were actually at the time that 9/11 was being plotted. You mentioned that you were just around the corner from where that was going on.
In Malaysia.
Malaysia, yeah. So have you ever wondered about that, and have you ever had to fend off suspicions or accusations of yourself being an operative?
I always have to fend that off. People assume that all the time, and it's a projection, yeah. You know, because I think we're living in an age where personal involvement in these things, especially from Americans, is very small. It's easier for us to comment upon what other people do than to actually do things. We don't travel as much as people in other countries. We are not exposed very much. When we're exposed to other cultures, it's because they've come to us. You know, as a New Yorker, you know, I know that, you know, you can encounter so many different cultures, languages, religions, simply by walking down the street. So there's a kind of incredulousness when people realize that someone like me has actually gone abroad, has, you know, left this country and gone to other countries, lived in other countries for long periods of time, traveled deeply in those places. It arouses suspicion immediately, you know, because that's not what we do, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, sure, I have to fend off the idea that I'm an operative of some kind. I mean, I was 17 years old when I first encountered that strange church in the Bronx that was operating basically as a cover for intelligence operations. At 17 years old, let's face it, I was not an operative. You know, I was not doing anything. I mean, I was still struggling to get out of high school. So, you know, I did a lot of things simply because it was there to do and I could do them, and why not? I was curious, definitely. I grew up at a time when conspiracy theory itself wasn't really highly evolved. There was investigative journalism, which was different, which was a rational approach to trying to understand what the powers that be were up to, what they were doing, and where the connections were. So it was a different kind of mentality. It wasn't a paranoid mentality necessarily, but it was one that said there's something deeper at work here in the world. And it started with me in two different ways. It began with a political awareness, as anybody growing up at that time and, you know, becoming 18 in 1968 with Vietnam and the Tet Offensive and Cronkite and the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, all these things going on, the assassinations that were taking place in 68. Yeah. You had a political awareness, but at the same time, there was a spiritual awareness that was also taking place. It was a time of tremendous cultural upheaval, and for me personally, it was involved with religion, ideas about religion and spirituality. So for me, these two things went hand in hand, which gave me this kind of weird perspective, I think.
Right. And I'm thinking that you must have wondered this yourself, in a sense, not whether you're an operative, but whether, like when you talk about quantum history and the particle and the wave theory, mm-hmm. of the JFK, sure. assassination or any event, like there are these forces, they don't have to be sinister ones, but that do seem to be directing things behind the scenes. I mean, there's the human element, and then there's perhaps a non-human element, and then there's definitely a completely unknown element, we could say divine or whatever name we want to put on it, even a liminal element, but the element that that can't be categorized. How much have you wondered about that? Like, you being in the right place at the right time has actually kind of made it inevitable that you've ended up on the path that you've ended up, and being this researcher and this spokesman that you've become.
Well, I think, you've raised a lot of questions. There's a lot of terms that we would want to define, probably. When we say there's the human element and there's an element that may not be human, I think in the first place, we don't really know what being human is. We're still in the process of trying to figure that out. There's more to humans than meets the eye, to coin a phrase. So I think that we're not necessarily comfortable in encountering capabilities of the human mind that we're supposed to not believe exist. That's part of the problem, I think. If you're a writer, like I am, and I've written fiction and nonfiction, when you get deeply involved in your subject matter, the synchronicities pile up. I mean, they pile up exponentially. You suddenly find yourself accidentally finding all the information you need. People that you never met before turn up and are willing to cooperate, to tell you things that you really needed to know. You start to see the world shift kind of in perspective, and all the things that you needed show up. You're suddenly on the river of the Tao, you might say. You're flowing with the Tao, and not being too specific about it, but you're suddenly finding that things are working. They're working as you work, and this is an unusual thing, but I'm not the only person who's mentioned this. I mean, there are people like I was just reading recently John Alexander, the military guy who wrote a book about UFOs, for instance. Even he, in the first opening pages of that book, says, it's really weird, but synchronicities start to pile up and suddenly people show up. And I think every writer that I've spoken with, and I've spoken with a number of them over the years, all insist on the same phenomenon. It's not something that's actually discussed a lot, but it happens. Mm-hmm. So a synchronicity of this information showing up is part of it, and there's another kind of synchronicity in which you yourself show up, in the right place at the right time, as you say. Whether this is an unconscious entanglement of connections between yourself and your subject matter, whether it's deliberate in some way, I don't know. I just know that it works, and I'm kind of grateful that it does.
There was a question I was going to save till the end, but I feel like it's appropriate now. Do you feel, as a writer, which is, I think we both agree, is a much broader and deeper term than most people realize, and more ambiguous, do you feel, what's your growing relationship to that identity as a writer, to the extent that, or in regard to you having a mission or a sense of a purpose or a larger goal in what you're doing? Do you have a sense of that, of a larger goal?
I think it's not necessarily a subject-object relationship. It's not as though I'm doing this or because of that. It's a natural function. So I don't often sit back and think about it in those terms. And yet, if something tries to interfere with the process, I can get very upset. And that's when I suddenly become aware, you might say, that there's more to this than simply my ego or my income or whatever it may happen to be, that there's something more central, to the work. It's difficult to say, and I think only, history will tell. But in the immediate present, when I'm working, when I'm involved in this, it's difficult to explain. It's a sense of empowerment as you're doing it. You feel that you're doing exactly the right thing that you're supposed to be doing. You're reinforced in this idea when the synchronicities, the coincidences start to multiply, and you just go with it. You don't question whether this is, a higher calling or not.
I have to say, I kind of almost have the opposite experience. I mean, not exclusively. I mean, not that I don't have the experience you're describing, but I also have this experience as a writer of this endless doubt. And that part of my writing exploration process, which I don't know if you'd be aware or not, but if you'd read anything I've written, you probably would be, it's always bringing it back to my own internal process, self-examination in the Socrates sense. Mm-hmm. That's my only gauge, in terms of feeling like I'm uncovering something or I'm doing something that has social worth or social impact. There's an endless doubt about that for various reasons. But I think, to go to the sort of larger step back to the larger perspective, it relates to this question of quantum history and the observation affects the outcome, that whole ball of wax, if you will. And sure. The by, and also I was just reading your blog and your about yourself that you'd written, and how you ended on the magician's task is to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent, and three out of four ain't bad. And how this may relate to writing. Obviously, you're comparing not keeping silent to writing, and it may be that one of the reasons that keeping silent about these things is prescribed is that if we testify to them, we are possibly reinforcing a reality that we may be seeding memes. I think we inevitably are, to the extent that we're read and the extent that we have influence. That's an area that I'm really unclear about in terms of the responsibility of the writer, which is why I always end up bringing it back to myself. And if I'm being as honest as I can about my own exploration, and if the writing process is allowing me to bust my own illusions, what it comes down to for me, then there's a liberation that comes about as a result of that. But one of the things that I've constantly come up against with conspiracy research is this doubt that, how do I know, and this would be for you, this would be much easier to answer, I'm sure, because you do the footwork, the trench work, how do I know that the clues that I'm finding and putting together and recontextualizing into a narrative haven't been planted in order for me to find them, so that I will then create a picture that is actually a cover story, another cover story?
Well, that's always going to be the danger on an existential level. As I say, the looking for validation in your writing, it comes from, I think, the writing itself. If you're writing requires a great degree of honesty. Yeah. You need to be as honest as you possibly can, which may mean that you're deluding yourself in the process if you don't know, you know, who you are, or you know, the extent of what is truth. And we're back to, you know, some very deep existential questions there. But the point is that what you write, what I write, what someone else writes is part of the aggregate. It's part of the whole. You may be uncovering, in a sense, another level of disinformation. You may be contributing to the level of disinformation, but as you're writing, you feel omniscient. But when you're published, you're not. Mm-hmm. The writer, as writing, is a creator, is a godlike creature to the work that he's creating. But then that work goes out there with all the other creatures and all the other gods who've created it. And I think that the reader, it's up to the reader to decide what is truth, what is not truth. Hence, we have bestsellers that are, you know, pretty crappy, and then we have, you know, books that are excellent, which nobody reads. But it's all out there. You know, every kind of angle on this, whether it's conspiracy literature or not. I mean, I get constantly called to speak on podcasts and things which are, you know, extreme right-wing radio or right-wing podcast things, which is incredible to me because, you know, anybody reading my work would not come away thinking that I was, you know, a Tea Party person or extreme right. And yet, that's what they're projecting onto the work. You know, it's very strange. So I then go and I try to, I will accept those invitations, and I do talk because I'm trying to say, listen, you know, all conspiracy theory is not the province of the extreme right, as it seems to be these days. It may have begun that way with None Dare Call It Treason back in the 50s and early 60s when there was a lot of conspiracy theory about Kennedy. But then there was conspiracy theory about FDR back in the 30s and 40s and on and on. And, you know, there's this political coloration to ideas about conspiracy, which is amusing to me because it's got nothing to do with that. It has more to do with power, how power is used and abused, relationships between people that are conducive to conspiracy or to secrecy or to plots and all of that. So if you're going to write something and you're worried about if you're contributing to the disinformation, all I can say is, you know, you base your work upon what is verifiable. If your work is good at all, it will be subject to the falsifiability test, right? Is it pure speculation, or is it based on some data that can be interpreted different ways? My point of view has always been: show the documentation, show the works. Make say this is what has actually happened. This is the documents that actually exist. Now you go and see if maybe you can come up with a different narrative that would fit this documentation, and that's fine. I have no problem at all with that. The only problem I have usually with critics is that they will attack the documents. They will say that I didn't say this, or I did say that when I didn't, or they will ignore the documentation and say that I'm writing works of speculation, and I don't. When I speculate, I pretty much say I'm speculating. So I think the honesty is in verifiability and falsifiability. The validation of your work comes if, have you been honest? Have you dealt with the material in a forthright way? You could be unconsciously contributing to disinformation. I think some conspiracy theorists have in the past. We can talk about Mark Lane as an example of somebody who might have been unwittingly contributing to the disinformation because of some of the things that he did and some of the investigation that he did over the years. Other people can make that accusation against me, perhaps. I don't know.
Other areas that you consciously, deliberately steer clear of, stay away from for whatever reasons?
I have steered away recently. I mean, the last 20, last not 20 years, but since 9/11, 2001, I've been kind of away from that subject matter. Everybody has sort of jumped on that bandwagon, trying to prove or disprove whether or not it was an inside job, who actually was responsible, et cetera, et cetera. I have kind of wanted to stay aloof from all of that. One of the reasons is all the documentation is not in. We really don't have enough information for me to sit back and say, aha, I think this is where we should go.
I'm sure you're aware there's something you might call conspiracy culture now, which is that the idea of conspiracy or conspiracy theorizing, as it's called, is becoming more mainstream as a phenomenon.
Yes.
Not so much the actual ideas themselves, or rather the possibilities that they're real, but just as this cultural phenomenon that's being written about and discussed.
Sure.
As a belief system, let's say, in the orthodox mainstream, whatever you want to call that, where the official voices are heard. It's being allowed as this phenomenon, as this cultural phenomenon, rather than as an actual reality. On the other hand, in the community that I'm more or less part of, somewhat liminally, somewhat on the edges of the margins, but conspiracy is just taken as a given, basically. That not exactly that everything is a conspiracy, but that any conspiracy, no matter how outlandish, is worth attention and is credible, pretty much. And because I'm not a researcher, I simply don't have the time or the inclination to really go into the documents and whatnot, and I wouldn't feel sure even then, because, as I say, how could I be absolutely sure that the documents hadn't been forged and planted, and it seems like there's no way to be absolutely 100% certain about these things. So I do tend to have a very open kind of lens, as in I'll take on any idea and just see how coherent it is. I'm not sure I'm going with this exactly. I'll bring out specific examples, like the moon landing is one that in the sort of circles that I frequent, let's say, it's more or less that the idea that the moon landing is faked. I wouldn't say it's taken as de rigueur, you know, as a fact, but it's definitely now pretty much obscured the previous belief that the moon landing actually happened. So it's kind of, there's this sort of liminal state where what we once thought of as facts, we've replaced with theories about conspiracies, and really ended up in a place where we simply don't know. I'd say this is the positive outcome anyway, that I simply don't know. I now know that I don't know if humans ever went to the moon or if that footage is real or not. And that to me seems like an interesting kind of place to be. That's liminality, or that's one aspect of liminality. There seems to be an opening in that, an opening of the mind, an opening of awareness, an opening of the senses even, and a kind of a recognition that we can't know many of these things. So this isn't necessarily leading to a question. I was listening to you or reading recently, and you did refer to the moon landing, and you referred to it as a fact. And I wondered about that. I wonder, is that just because there's too much to go into if you even question it, or is it just something that you have researched and you've dismissed? Or what's your, I mean, specifically about that, but also maybe as a response to all the other stuff I've said, I'd be interested to hear your take on this.
Sure, it's quite a lot to address. Let's say you're absolutely right as far as conspiracy culture is concerned, and part of the reason for that is our sources of news have failed us miserably, especially in the last 15 years or so. Our news outlets are basically just mouthpieces. They're giving us press releases from the government or from corporations, and you know, the Woodwards and Bernsteins are not around anymore. Or if they are, their mantle has been taken over by bloggers who are doing the best that they can with limited resources at their disposal. So what began as really legitimate investigative journalism has now basically descended into a kind of free-for-all of theory. I have a problem with a lot of conspiracy theory. I have a problem with the term because it, you know, it's a term that devalues any kind of investigation or any kind of questioning of the status quo of the consensus reality. So I don't like the term conspiracy theory. It's used as a pejorative. But let's just talk about it in general and say, okay, you know, the problem I have with people who theorize endlessly is they do so without data. Or they cherry pick data to, you know, to fit a preconceived idea, which is the opposite of what an investigative journalist should do, which is a more scientific approach. Let's just accumulate the data and see what it tells us. So I have a problem there. I mean, as a person who's physically gone to places of some danger, you might say, in Latin America or in Asia or places like that, I know that the reality is quite often very different. You know, you need, as I've said in, I think in Sinister Forces, I said, you need the documents and the blood. I mean, both of these things are necessary. You can't build a theory of reality just on the documents, and you can't do it just upon your personal experience. There's got to be a kind of connection. Your personal experience will never be broad enough to include everything, all of reality. And the documents will never give you the taste of what actually happened, what people were thinking at a time when something went down. So you need both, and you need to actually get out there and do it. But there's, you know, no one's paying for that anymore. You have one guy that they send out to the Middle East, and all the networks use him and his feeds. You know, it's become like that, and it's a corporate game, and with media in charge of so few corporate owners, you know, our information has become tailor-made. And so we're stuck with trying to figure out the truth on our own, and that's why we do what we do. That's why people have conspiracy theories, and that's why conspiracy culture is becoming the norm. As far as the moon landing is concerned, I haven't seen enough documentation to disprove it. I've seen a lot of speculation. I've seen a lot of, you know, ideas as to, you know, what really happened or what didn't. But I kind of tend to agree that the moon landing did take place. Why not? I mean, we sent so many ships up there and down that were observed by telescopes around the world, that were observed by the Russians, certainly, and all the rest of it. But that said, what you're talking about is part of a continuum of consciousness, I think, part of a new paradigm that's taking place, not just in our culture, but in the world in general. We're questioning the moon landing at the same time that people are asking questions, for instance, about UFOs, about alien technology, about alien abductions. We're questioning reality, what we think of as reality. We're questioning in general on so many aspects. We're questioning the political reality in this country and in other countries. We're questioning, you know, the Russians, what are they really up to in Ukraine? What are they really up to with NATO? On and on. We're starting to question everything because nobody else is. And we're not getting a straight answer. Or if we are getting straight answers, they're simply unbelievable. And maybe the unbelievability is what's important. Maybe, for instance, the U.S. government has no clue about UFOs, as an example. Take the most extreme example. Maybe the U.S. government really doesn't have a clue. Maybe they just don't want to go there. Maybe because they don't have the technology to deal with it, or they don't have an imminent or immediate threat to deal with, so they don't deal with it. Maybe the reality is much scarier than that, you know. Maybe we're all sitting here living in a kind of fool's paradise where things have already taken place of which we are not aware. So we've lost faith in our institutions in general. We lost faith in our churches, I think, a long time ago. We lost faith in our political systems a long time ago, beginning with the assassinations, beginning with Vietnam, maybe going back even further. So we've lost faith in all of this. The economy is wiping out the middle class in this country, which was the bastion of consensus reality for so long. So I think that this upheaval is taking place on an unconscious level, and we're reacting to it by believing six impossible things before breakfast.
Right. Were you familiar with the liminality, the concept, the anthropological concept?
Certainly, of course, from the Victor Turner, you know, end of it.
Yeah.
Certainly, because, you know, I did eventually get a degree in religious studies, so liminality was definitely part of it, and I think that writing in itself is a liminal occupation. You're in a world where something is uncreated and yet wants to be created. You're an interface between an idea and something that appears as a physical artifact. So I think that writing is liminal, and I think that writers are, you know, ideally posed to understand liminality and to describe it.
Hmm. But I brought it up this time because of what you're talking about, the institutions and the growing distrust in institutions, which of course relates to the conspiracy culture, where essentially we don't trust anything, you know, any of the institutions to represent the truth or to you know, to do the right thing, or to, we just don't trust. I was listening to you saying today, not that you were saying it today, I was listening to it today, about priests and how in your day people naturally trusted priests, whereas now they're naturally suspicious of them. There's the, I'm sure you've been aware of in the UK, the growing revelations about the paedophile networks throughout the government in the UK. It was kind of kick-started by the Jimmy Savile revelations.
Yep.
And of course, again, this is hugely destabilizing for the institutions. I mean, in the past, the paedophilia fear, it even seemed like hysteria, of course now it seems almost inadequate, but it was directed kind of irrationally at, you know, any weird-looking Jeffrey Dahmer-like neighbours or what have you, the misfits, whereas now, with what we know, it's clear that the ones to suspect are people in positions of power, or at least people with access, the teachers, the priests, the ministers, the politicians. So there's really, like, the very people in the institutions that we as citizens, if you like, have needed most badly to trust are the very same ones that we're finding it harder and harder to trust. And I relate this to the liminality in the this in its sense is a liminal period. It's a period of uncertainty, a period of structures are collapsing, or at least they appear like they may collapse at any time, and a period of uncertainty, of chaos. And I'm curious about your take on this as far as how it relates to the Girardian idea of mimesis, in that they say, I have read, you may dispute it or want to clarify your opinion on this, but that in periods of liminality, we can't turn to the institutions and the kind of established standards and values and morals, they're all under threat, if you will, they're all dissolving. So there's that uncertainty and confusion about how to behave, and therefore we look to others to see how to behave. So mimesis intensifies. And then the possibility of charisma being used and abused in that liminal state of intensified mimesis increases also. So there's this idea of false ceremony masters, which relates to the trickster archetype, who even generate these periods of liminality, who bring about revelations that will cause that will destabilize the institutions in order to create the chaotic liminal period, and then to accrue power within that as these false ceremony masters. I say false because the real ceremony master was one who'd actually been through the liminal phase and come out the other side and was simply there to guide the initiate, like a beacon, like a lighthouse, if you will, whereas what we're talking about here is it's a false liminality because it's being generated not as an initiation but merely to exploit that the chaos in order to accrue power within it. So the false ceremony master uses his or her or their charisma, you could think of Hollywood here and mass media, to take advantage of the mimetic qualities in people and get them to control them, basically through that mimetic drive to imitate.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite a mouthful to answer. let me start from the beginning, or at least the beginning as I understand it. I think that part of the conspiracy culture that we started talking about, which leads directly into this, has to do really with a scientific approach to reality. It's the fruit of the scientific revolution, because what does a scientist do but question everything, take nothing for granted, and especially go after the sacred cow, such as religion or political structures and that sort of thing. The scientist does not accept what he or she has been told. They have to go and test. It has to be verifiable. It has to be subject to prediction and to testing. And I think that people have realized they've been lied to so consistently that they now distrust everything. They want to go back and start from the beginning, essentially, and see what there is that they can on which they can rely. Something hard, something tangible, because we've been living in a world of absolute false reality, to the point where we've invaded countries and started wars and killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on the basis of, you know, false information. This, I think, started, as I say, way back in my lifetime. I could sort of pinpoint it to, the Kennedy assassination probably as a touchstone for my generation, but it probably started a lot earlier for other people. Mm. And it was this idea that we must question. We are being lied to by someone, maybe by a lot of people, maybe by everyone. So hence, you have a conspiracy culture. You have people who are going to question everything. And as you say, we're living in a liminal period. Because if you start questioning everything and there's nothing to rely upon, you're going to be looking for people who have gone and come back, as you say, someone who has crossed that liminal threshold and is coming back with the charisma, with the gift of the sight, of the gift of the experience, the initiatory experience. And we don't know how to judge that. We don't have what the Christian fundamentalists call the gift of discernment. So we're going to see individuals come back who claim they have gone there and come back. And through our desperation, we're going to believe them. You mentioned the trickster, and that's a very liminal figure, of course. In alchemy, that would have been mercury. Mercury, which is sometimes a solid, sometimes a liquid. Mercury, which is a transmitter of information, of communication, the lord of the crossroads. All of this, a very liminal character, not just as the trickster, but in ancient terms as the actual god himself. So we identify with people like that. We identify with those people who claim they've been there and come back. How did we start back in the 1970s by idolizing serial killers, as an example? We have Thomas Harris to thank for that, by creating something, a character like Hannibal Lecter, who has all the charisma of a shaman, of someone who's gone through the entire process of being broken down and being built back up, and during the shamanic retreat, coming back and telling us, you know, what we all think we know about sexuality, about violence, about reality is wrong. He epitomized the intelligent, urbane person who was simultaneously a mass murderer. We started to identify with people like that because they seemed real. They seemed as though there was nothing particularly phony about them. Their violence, their proclivity towards in Lecter's case, mass murder, was wrapped in this idea that Lecter was a psychiatrist, a healer of mental illness. You know, so he was a shaman. You know, he did go and come back as a psychiatrist. He would have been analyzed, you know, by other analysts, by other psychiatrists, in order to get his certification. So we believe that this is a person who's gone there and come back and has something to tell us. And we're titillated by him because he's giving us this message that the shaman can do no wrong, that whatever the shaman does is okay. And that has led, that's blown open the doors to all sorts of ideas about who we are, what is reality, what are ethics, what are morals. And we're looking at people who are lying to us so consistently. And we realize that this is all part of part of our reality now. This is all part of what we have to expect. You know, we have science on the one hand, which seems to have betrayed us. And yet we do have a scientific approach. We want to question everything and test everything. But we don't have the tools to do that. Part of the joke that's on us is that we were never given those tools. We were just told, trust me, everything will be fine. And because of that, we no longer have the tools of discernment. We no longer know who's lying to us and who isn't. So we jump on the more attractive of all the alternatives that are out there.
Well, this is not that just that we no longer have these tools, but that we, as individuals, we never developed them, right?
Right. Well, we would have to actually go through an initiatory process in order to start developing those tools. I'm reminded of Israel Regardi, who, you know, compiled that famous collection of rituals of the Golden Dawn and published them to everyone's dismay, I suppose, who was in the Golden Dawn. But his he always told people not to even embark on a path of spiritual study and initiation unless you had first gone through a period of psychoanalysis. We need to find out where our personal weaknesses are because we've been numbed to them. Our churches have not allowed us really to explore that. Science poo-poos it. We can't afford, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for depth psychology lasting over 10 or 20 years. So we're stuck with trying to do this ad hoc, you know, the dummy's guide to spiritual enlightenment, you know. So we're trying to figure out what's the fast way to do this because we're running out of time. And there is no fast way, not really. So we have people who are extremely violent and at the same time extremely charismatic who are saying, trust me, follow us this way. You know, this will be fine. Don't worry about a thing. And naturally, we're now suspicious and we're, you know, we don't know where to turn and we become desperate. Oh,
Well, I think this relates to certainty and uncertainty, for one thing, that the liminal state is to be endless doubt, perpetually uncertain, and so then we look to those who have certainty as to lead us through it. But, of course, those who have certainty are not necessarily those who've gone through the other side, but merely those who've... there's various ways of putting that, but a psychopath is certainly very certain and has very strong convictions. Sure. So I think that this relates to the unconscious, everything does, I suppose, but how I've been thinking about how the liminal, the novitiate, that is the liminal phase in the tribal society, has to do with the coming of age ritual being a way for individuals to learn to trust their unconscious. Because essentially it's a period in which they can do all, commit all the taboo acts, you know, the social restrictions are lifted temporarily and they're kind of identified with the divine, and like gods, like tricksters, they're allowed to do anything, essentially, and the community has to hold a space for that emergence of the id. And it seems to me that that's a way for... an individual to come of age by seeing that it's okay to trust in those unconscious urges and let them come through one and express themselves, and that the community won't reject them for it. And so that would engender a trust in the individual, not just in the community, but in their own unconscious. And therefore, in place of certainty, they would have an inner connection, a connection to their inner, to their unconscious, to guide them through life.
That's, well, correct. And the problem is we don't have that space any longer. We haven't created a space for this to take place. If we read Eliade, if we read, shamanism, his famous text on shamanism, we know that shamans were sent out into the wilderness for a period of time to do just that. That was their space. They underwent all of these tribulations. They underwent the initiatory phase where they were taken apart limb by limb, where their organs were removed and replaced, and they had visions, and they came back whole, and they came back from this experience, and they became a benefit, an asset to their society. They were able to talk to the gods. They were able to predict things. They were able to heal. We don't have a space for that anymore, except in psychiatric institutions. You know, if someone undergoes a process like this, they are institutionalized. They're given drugs, and they're kept in a state of limbo, in a liminal state, you might say, forever. Yeah. Not allowed to come back, not allowed to go forward. I mean, they're just stuck in this suspended animation. And I think that's the problem that we have in our society. We don't have a space for the shaman, for the real experience of shamanism, which is dangerous and it's scary. You know, we don't want dangerous and scary. We want to be anesthetized to that. We don't believe that it's good to undergo, you know, a very trying emotional, psychological period in which just to basically to reset ourselves or to go to another level of awareness and empowerment and spirituality. We don't believe in it because we've lost faith in all of this.
Yeah.
We don't trust psychiatrists anymore. That's certainly true. Ever since all the MKUltra stuff has come out and all the revelations about how psychiatry has been put at the service of, you know, of the state, how can we even trust anthropologists? You know, anthropology has been put at the service of the state. You know, there's been the Minerva Project, for instance, from the Department of Defense, which, you know, enlist anthropologists basically to spy on other cultures and, you know, do, you know, anti-terrorism work. I mean, we can't trust our academics. We can't. Academia itself has become such a mess. You know, people fighting for tenure, people saying what, you know, what they're supposed to say, people you know, writing what they're supposed to write. Everything is questionable at this point. Even the methods that they use are questionable, and we are sitting, you know, at the mercy of all of these forces. And there's nothing probably more important in our lives than understanding the nature of reality, understanding spirituality, understanding all of this. This is our life, our lives that are at stake, and yet we're not given any assistance or any freedom to figure out what all of that means. We're just being told to do this or to do that or to trust someone. And, you know, we have to work. we have to spend a lot of time doing things that do not deliberately or directly contribute to our spiritual well-being. And so we live a long life, and towards the end of it, if we're lucky, we have a year or two to think about it, and then it's all over. This is a very depressing state of affairs, in the West in particular. You know, there's other cultures that don't, they're not suffering quite this badly. But these other cultures, though, are impoverished cultures. And they're looking to us for guidance, unfortunately. And they're trying to maybe replace the spiritual longings with material possessions the way we've seemed to have done it, and the kind of culture that we're exporting to the rest of the world.
There seems to be an overriding desire to escape the unconscious and to create this semblance of reality or of existence that denies the existence of the unconscious completely, and therefore...
Wouldn't you? I mean, at this point, at this point, our unconscious is probably a real basket of snakes, you know. We've suppressed so much. We've lied to ourselves. We've been lied to. You know, going into our unconscious may not be the best thing for society as a whole anymore. And yet it's something that is necessary. What are we going to do? It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Catch-22 is the description of liminality, isn't it? You know,
right. The double bind also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking, because when you were talking about this, all the different disciplines being untrustworthy, I was thinking, well, it's to do with, I wouldn't say a result of, because it's the chicken and the egg question, as always, but
sure.
To do with them being infiltrated, like every single discipline, every single field has been infiltrated, whether it's by Christian missionaries, whether it's by intelligence operatives, if there's even a difference. And how, I mean, that kind of snake pit, as you put it, is just impossible at this point to try and actually negotiate or navigate. But perhaps, and this is where I try to find a context or a unifying theory that I actually can experience directly, it relates, again, to the unconscious, and how if we deny the existence of the unconscious, it takes over, it takes control of us, paradoxically.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know? Even it is the source of wisdom, but if we deny it, it becomes a devil, a satanic quote-unquote force, because it's, I suppose, it relates to the reptilian brain, like the deepest layer of the unconscious is the one that takes control, because that's the one that's powerful, that's driven by the most basic fundamental drives. And so, yeah, we become driven by that, you know, the dark aspect of the unconscious. It's all dark in the sense that it's unconscious, but there seems to be an aspect that just really is dark, you know. Its very nature is dark, in that it's predatory or
sure.
I mean, when it takes over the whole system, it becomes destructive, but also empowering. And I mean, the experience can be of empowerment. And so see how this relates to the desire for certainty, and how certainty actually isn't. I don't think it's really an option for a true individuatory or an individuating journey. I don't think we ever attain certainty. That's my experience. It feels like I get further and further away from certainty the deeper I go into my own inner space, if you will. But that's okay. You don't need it, because there's something that knows. But if you do want certainty because of your own trauma or, you know, whatever it is, but the unconscious, as you put it, is too frightening to go that way, so you have to move the other way to this semblance of certainty. And then it's about creating this identity that is powerful, that has certainty, that has convictions, which is this Hannibal Lecter that you're describing, I mean, that as a metaphor for that, which I would say is Jimmy Savile. One of the reasons I find this history so interesting is that he does seem to embody much more closely than Lecter did, because Lecter was fictional, the false individuation of the psychopath, which is very Ayn Randian, in fact. And I know that Ayn Rand actually expressed admiration for a serial killer. I forget his name. I don't know if you read about that, but her philosophy did extend to actually holding up a serial murderer as an exemplary of the perfect man.
Well, she did as well with James Bond. You know, she idolized both. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Ted Bundy, but I could be mistaken. As for the serial killer, I don't remember.
It was an obscure one, actually. I'd not heard of.
An obscure one? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But so you have a serial killer and you have James Bond. And what is James Bond basically but, you know, a serial killer in service of the state?
Yeah.
So sure. I mean, she did understand it from that point of view. I mean, she was looking for that sociopathic, you know, certainty. It's again, you brought up the idea of mimesis. I guess you're speaking in terms of the René Girard, you know, approach to mimesis. I mean, who are we then going to imitate? I mean, who? What is the person we're identifying with, or the group, or the quality that our culture at this stage of the game? We need to know that, because we need to know who's going to be scapegoated if Girard's, you know, template is operable. Mm. So we're going to have to figure out, okay, number one, who are we imitating? Because that's going to give us an idea as to who the scapegoat is eventually going to be.
And how not to be the scapegoat.
Well, yeah, hopefully, sure. So we're going to need to know that. And I think that it's constantly shifting. I think we're constantly shifting in what we think we want, who we want to emulate, who we think that is the charismatic leader, whether it's a cultural leader or a political or whatever it happens to be. We keep changing that too. Part of the problem with our media, our news cycles, and the internet in general, is that we don't really fix on one given individual or topic or cultural icon. We do shift constantly. That might be a good thing, because we're not going to become followers of a specific individual or group. But on the other hand, you know, it might just be evidence of the fact that we are on shifting sands. We don't know who we are, which may be good for the potential scapegoats out there, because the scapegoat also will constantly shift, you know, until we've settled on one paradigm that we're going to stick with, you know, for the duration. I don't know. I mean, in my years of watching what's gone on, we do tend to shift from, you know, being the cheerleader for this or that group or party or organization or cultural artifact. We don't really fix on anything for any length of time. We had the church for that. You know, the church was giving us who we should hate and who we should like, but now they've lost their credibility. The government's lost its credibility, so we're stuck now with a kind of general consensus view, which shifts so it's fickle. I mean, nothing really stays the same. So I think that the Girardian concept is on a quicksand basis right now. We don't really know where that's going to lead us. We don't have an idea. You know, we're looking at you know, today it's this and tomorrow it's that. We are looking to poke holes in all of our sacred cows. We're looking for clay feet in all the idols. And if there's no idols left, are we then stuck looking into a mirror and, you know, making up a decision that we're going to be our own idol? Is that where it comes down to? And if it comes down to that, then who becomes the scapegoat? Becomes the scapegoat.
Come on, take one to go to sleep.
So how would you see Hollywood factoring in all of this? Because it seems as though that's a heavy machinery of mimesis, and that's
sure.
Those are very sacred cows, and it's almost as though at this stage people trust and look to celebrities more than they do anyone else, perhaps because they're very liminal and the element of fantasy is very obviously very dominant, but it's conscious as well. I mean, there's an awareness that one is participating in the empowerment of the celebrity by admiring them and by worshipping them and by imitating them.
Well, celebrities give us fantasy, and at the same time they're giving us certainty. The message in Hollywood films on the surface is formulaic. I mean, it's, you know, it is violence and the sacred. That's basically all Hollywood is about.
Right.
I always find it remarkable how every single movie involving violence, involving the white hats against the black hats, the good guys against the bad guys, always ends with the good guy having either being stronger, stronger physically than the bad guy, or having more technology. Mm. We've idolized these ideas to the point where we think that's what solves problems. We're always going to win because we're the strongest, or we have the more guns, we have the more technology, or we don't run out of bullets as fast, or whatever it happens to be. It's not a victory based upon moral issues. It's not a victory based upon anything other than might makes right. Whether it's a, you know, whether it's a cartoon, or whether it comes down to you know, something very violent, name it, you know, almost any film in the last 20, 30 years, has always been, you know, how do we make the famous cowboy films, right? We killed a lot of Native Americans, and we did it because they had bows and arrows and we had guns. It was not a moral victory of any kind. It was strictly a victory based upon technology. We've idolized technology for that long, that technology is its own moral authority. And so that's the message we're getting from Hollywood quite often, is that our tools, since we are homo faber, our tools are what makes us morally justified to do whatever it is we want to do. Isn't that the whole colonialist approach anyway? You know, something that Edward Said, you know, railed against in a flawed, I think, approach to the problem. But still, you know, we're talking about the fact that the colonial powers had the ships, they had the guns, they had the will to go into other countries and dominate them, and that made it right. You know, the others were godless, you know, pagan, or they were not Christian, certainly, so we had the right to go and enslave all of these people because of this. And we're still reinforcing that image constantly in Hollywood. It's a colonialist perspective, and we still embrace it. There's very little that's done to, you know, to encourage us to find other solutions to problems other than the violent solution. There's really no other way. We're not being shown a pacifist approach to this problem. Or, you know, I think Girard called it a pacifist mimesis, right? I mean, the kind of peaceful, you know, approach that's going to involve, you know, people of like minds, you know, making a rational decision between them. Because there is no person of right mind. There are no enemies with which we can have a conversation. Our enemies hate us and we hate them. There's no common ground, you know, and there won't be unless there is, as Douglas MacArthur once said famously years ago, unless we're being attacked by some, you know, other alien forces from some other galaxy. I think even Ronald Reagan, in front of the United Nations, made that speech as well, you know. Almost wishful thinking, hoping that, you know, there would be an alien force attacking the Earth so we would all get together and defend ourselves. I think that's going to be it. It's going to be a violent confrontation again that brings all these people together, just as it's bringing us together with Iran in the Middle East these days, sometimes and sometimes not. You know, these are all marriages of convenience. There is no real marriage. There's no heroes gamos taking place among all of this. These are marriages of convenience that will disappear and dissipate as soon as the violent threat is removed, and we're back to square one.
Shotgun marriages, even.
Yeah, that's all they are.
Yeah. I guess you're familiar with the term negative identity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of the phenomenon that individuals and groups reinforce their sense of identity by juxtaposing it with the other, with the opposition, by taking an oppositional stance to some other, which of course relates to the scapegoat mechanism,
mm-hmm.
Although it's not synonymous. And it seems like something we do as individuals as well, like to, because the thing of the scapegoat is the group that, in order not to have internal conflict within and destroy itself, it needs the scapegoat. It needs to all agree that this individual is guilty, then we'll kill him, then we'll raise him up and make him sacred, and we'll, you know, stay together until the next build-up of tension requires another scapegoat. It seems like as individuals we do this also, like we may be this multiplicity, that the ego is merely an imposition on this internal multiplicity of consciousness that gives us this false sense of unification, but that we need it desperately, and the way that we maintain it and the way that we prevent the internal conflict from completely disrupting our inner unity, which would be a schizophrenic or shamanic dismemberment, is we constantly look for an individual or a group or an ideology to oppose and define ourselves by, or of course a partner, and this happens in marriages, because the one we love becomes the, you know, the antithetical other.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't lead to a question, but
that's fine. Well, I think that I can only talk about a specific instance that shows you just how this works. I mean, when the Berlin Wall came down and when the Soviet Union fell, I was talking to a bunch of people who were in the military right around that time. And they were saying, oh, how great this is. You know, that's going to be the end. We're going to be, you know, this was the major problem and now everything's going to be fine. And I looked at them like they were insane. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, no, it's not. The Middle East is about to explode. You're going to have a lot of really serious problems in the Middle East, especially with extremism and all of that, which I almost experienced directly when I was in China. At one point, I was in Beijing, and I was in a taxi, and on another street, there was a huge explosion, and it was rebels from Xinjiang province, from the extreme western part of China, who had blown up a bus. They were separatists, and they were Islamic, Muslims, and they were, you know, fighting against the Chinese communist domination of their part of the world. I said, you know, there's a whole lot of enemies out there, and we're going to find one, you know, and we're going to, you know, consolidate, you know, our military forces and increase military spending because we're going to identify another threat. I said, the world is full of threats, and we're going to define ourselves by what threat it is. We defined ourselves in my generation growing up with communism. I mean, communism was the other, you know, so if you were soft on communism, you weren't an American. You weren't a patriotic citizen. Now you're not a patriotic citizen if you see, you know, the situation in the Middle East very pragmatically. You know, if you don't jump on the bandwagon and talk about Islamic extremism and jihadism and all the rest of it, well, then you're not an American. You're not to be trusted. We constantly, as a nation, as in the United States, we constantly define ourselves in terms of our enemies. You know, the only times that we didn't, we had tremendous prosperity. It's the end of the 19th century. We didn't have much in the way of enemies. Not, you know, national enemies. But then there was World War I, and we decided to get involved in that in 1917. And then, of course, World War II, et cetera, et cetera. We began defining ourselves this way. You know, the world is full of enemies, and the United States is going to be the policeman of the world, the cowboy, you know, of the Wild West. And that's our self-definition. We just don't have the culture, and I mean that in all senses of the word, we don't have the culture to define ourselves in any other way.
Hmm. Because when it's not inner oriented.
Right. We are only thinking in terms of duality. There's only a right and a left. There's only the right way and the wrong way, the right way and the non-American way. We love simple solutions to complex problems. And a simple solution is always going to involve a scapegoat. You can't have a complex solution and still have a scapegoat. You know, a scapegoat is like is a single identity. It's a single entity. it's one-dimensional. You know, a scapegoat has no further dimensions than that. Because once a scapegoat has three dimensions, or God forbid, four dimensions, then we don't know what we're doing. We don't know how to handle it.
Right.
The Middle East, for instance, is our scapegoat these days. That's a multi-dimensional, multi-layered, multi-valenced problem. And we don't want to think of it in those terms. We just want an easy answer. We want an easy identification of the enemy. And as long as we keep doing that, this country is going to keep being stuck in the situation that it is. We don't understand about what we're actually doing. We don't understand our desire to scapegoat. We don't understand it at all. We think we're doing the right thing. And that's why I've written the kind of books that I've written, which call into question some of America's own attitudes in terms of what the Third Reich did. You know, all of the support of the Nazi Party in the United States during the 1930s and the 1940s. And then even after the war, long after the war, you know, the idea that we supported people like this, the easy solution people, you know, against the Soviet Union or against the Chinese or against, you know, Latin American rebels in Central America and South America. We wanted, you know, scapegoats. We desperately need them in order to understand who we are. Manifest Destiny was all about going west and, you know, subduing the native populations there. This is how we defined ourselves as a nation. In order for us to change it, we're going to have to change our culture. We're going to have to change a lot of things. And that's just too hard. It's just too difficult.
You're talking specifically about Americans, obviously, or the U.S., but is it, I mean, do you think that it's so different in the U.S., or is it just magnified, what you're talking about, this condition?
Well, it's probably just magnified. You know, I've lived and traveled abroad a lot. You know, there's a lot of the similar sentiments, but I don't always realize, I don't quite understand sometimes if some of the same cultural biases are there naturally or if they're there in reaction to ours. You know, it's kind of hard to judge that. America, because it is so large in terms of the world consciousness, it's so powerful militarily and economically. It has an undue influence in other countries, I mean, to a really large extent. So it's really hard to understand sometimes what you're looking at when you're looking at another country's ideological stance, when you're looking at other countries' cultural proclivities. You don't know if that's really spontaneously from, you know, their own culture or if it's in reaction to what they perceive as American imperialism or dominance of their culture. You know, when you throw your weight around, someone's going to throw the weight back. And they'll probably do it the same way you're doing it. I mean, again, mimesis.
Yeah.
So there's going to be this kind of, you know, copying of what we are, of who what we represent, in order to seize that which we seem to want. So this kind of conflict, again, going back to Girard that he talks about, I think is taking place on a global scale, if we can use his ideas and, you know, port them to a sort of geopolitical framework.
Yeah, well, the metaphor that Girard offers for easy understanding is two children playing, and then one of them grabs a toy, and the other child sees that toy and thinks, I want that, simply because the first child has grabbed
right.
it, and the mimetic rivalry begins. So the very desire to be like the other means you end up desiring the same things, means you end up in conflict. So you could see how in the US it's setting itself up as this bastion of progress, of certainty, of comfort, and all the rest of it means that other nations, other peoples want to imitate that, and then they end up in competition and in conflict with it.
Par le fatal ennui, par l'amour qui se meurt. Passion trop mûrie, qui un matin n'est plus, par la noire pesanteur, par le silence meurtri, la jalousie mesquine, qui détruit peu à peu, par le semblant d'histoire, par la réputation, un coup de bienséance. Entre nos corps nus, sauvons-nous, je t'en prie.
to me just a moment ago that it, I wonder if it relates at all to being a displaced people, because I was thinking about the US and how it began with the genocide of the Native Americans, the sort of cycle of violence that the United States perpetuates, and how that relates, of course, to that it wasn't their country sure. to begin with, which made me think of mm-hmm. Israel. Again, we've got this displaced people with a history of aggression and intolerance and self-righteousness, mm-hmm. I guess, is a very major element of that, which, of course, would relate to liminality again. A displaced people doesn't feel connected to its environment in the way that it does if it's actually grown out of it, in a sense, or developed naturally in it. I don't even know how that would be described within the field of epigenetics and all the rest of it. But
no, I agree. I agree entirely. I mean, we don't have roots here. We really don't. You know, Americans do not have, you know, a long history of being in America. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, we brought slaves over from Africa. You know, we displaced the Native Americans. I mean, the idea of population, you know, divergence, if you will, was constant in our history. You know, we're constantly moving around. We're constantly taking other people's territory. We're bringing some of our religions and our ideas and our mores with us, and they get sort of sublimated here in different ways. There is no direct connection. I wrote about in Sinister Forces that we're living in a haunted house, and we don't know it. You know, we're stepping all over the graves of people who had lived here long before us. We're stepping on, you know, monuments that they built, you know, earthworks that are phenomenal, huge, massive things. We just don't know. We don't care. We build, you know, prisons on top of them. We do all kinds of strange things here because we just don't know where we are. We don't have a connection to this land. The Native Americans might also have been, you know, latecomers to the territory, but at least they developed a connection to the land, you know, centuries and centuries before we arrived. So, and now we still don't have a connection because we move around so much. You know, we're not defined by the area we grew up in anymore. You meet people who've come from all over. Right now I'm in South Florida. And in South Florida we've got more New Yorkers probably than there are in the Bronx, but yet here, you know, here they all are. And, you know, you meet someone who's a native Floridian and it's a big deal. You know, it's like this is an anomaly. We live in a constant state of liminality, if you will. You know, we're just not connected geographically, we're not, culturally we're not. We're speaking a language that's not really our own. You know, most of us speaking English, our ancestors did not speak English.
Well, there's a idea which I've verified for myself, which is a psychological idea, which is that if we're feeling a certain way and we're not able to express it or even become conscious of it, what we will do is we will make others feel the way that we're mm-hmm. feeling and communicate it that way. So this happens in marriages all the time. Communication breaks down and attack begins, and, you know, irrational emotional attacks, and the other person ends up feeling exactly how the first person was feeling mm-hmm. but wasn't able to communicate. They have effectively communicated, you could say, but not in the most healthy of ways. And it was occurring to me that the US, as you were saying, they're constantly moving around, and so they're sort of stuck in this liminal compulsion, whatever that is. But they're also, I mean, the notorious foreign policy is that the US is constantly invading these other countries and forcing them into this displaced liminal experience, as if to inflict upon others what they themselves can't deal with, can't consciously process.
Well, sure. I mean, if you travel, you go overseas, as I have for God, more than 20 years, 30 years, something like that, there's no question in your mind, as there was to many Americans after September 11th, when they said, why do they hate us? My reaction is, are you kidding me? You know, really? You don't know? There's, you know, the idea that we've displaced people everywhere, that we not only displaced people, we displaced cultures, you know, which is even more important. We displace language. You know, English has become the lingua franca around the world. Maybe in 20, 30 years it'll be Mandarin, I don't know. But right now it's English. And when you adopt another language, whether it's for business or whatever it happens to be, it does change consciousness, it does alter your thought patterns. I'm convinced of it. When I studied Mandarin back in the 70s, and I've used it in China, in traveling in China and doing business there, you do change the way you perceive a problem, the way you perceive a situation, the way you perceive personal reactions undergoes a slight shift because now you're doing it, you know, in a different context. The language, you know, is part of that context, or maybe it's central to the context. English does that too. We've displaced that. We've displaced it with Hollywood. We've displaced it with music. We've displaced cultures everywhere. They're fighting back little by little. If you live in Southeast Asia these days, American culture is not as powerful as, for instance, Korean culture, oddly enough. You know, Korean television is very popular in countries where they don't speak Korean. Korean music, Korean videos, Korean pop music has become very popular, for instance. You know, you see this idea, this pushback. You know, let's adopt the methodologies that the United States uses, and let's try to use our own culture as the filter through which we can do this. I mean, so there's this idea that we're trying to take back our culture, but is it really happening? When you have Gangnam style, you know, Korean videos, is that really purely Korean, or is that, you know, a Korean response to an American concept? And, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, that's going to be for social commentators to come up with later, if that, you know, contributed to some sort of erosion of Korean culture in this particular case. But it's true, it's a fact, it's happening, and we have to understand that it's happening and find a way to address it. So, yes, we're displacing people through war. We're displacing people through economics. And we're displacing culture, for sure. And we're displacing, of course, language as part of the cultural displacement that's taking place. And that's why people, you know, are reacting. That's why there's a lot of people who are against not just the United States, but the West in general, as they perceive the entire West to be this vast colonialist, imperialist power that's bent on, you know, ruining the cultures and spirituality of people around the world.
Because it'd be a way to assert, I mean, a way to avoid that distress or that anxiety of being liminal, of being displaced, is to displace others, not just because it's putting one's own demons into them, so to speak, poison receptacles is what Lloyd Demers calls it, the psychohistorian, but also because it reinforces. It's very much like the pattern of abuse. I mean, the powerless can only feel powerful by overpowering others and causing them to feel powerless and putting the poisons and the anxiety into them and reinforcing the illusion that, in fact, they are powerful.
Well, we have to keep doing it because it validates the original crime. Right. You know, we have to invade other countries because that validates the fact that we invaded this one. I mean, it makes it look right. It makes it look like it's part of the pattern of history, that it's an inevitability in a Marxian sense. So we're saying that this is what we do, and it's right and justified because we always win when we do it. You know, our displacement of the Native Americans is then paralleled in the displacement in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, not to make too broad a point, but this is what we're doing. We're displacing hundreds of thousands of other people, killing off a bunch of others, and they are quote-unquote others. And we're doing that, and we feel justified in doing it, or we don't feel justified, but we have to keep reliving that original crime to get to the point where we feel comfortable with it. And we're never going to feel comfortable with it. That's just a foregone conclusion. We're never going to feel comfortable with having, you know, slaughtered the Native Americans, and slaughtering a bunch of Iraqis is not going to improve it. But yet, in our psyche, I think that's all part of it. Mm. The way people talk, if you listen to, you know, some of the talk radio, which is vitriolic, and the type of conversation that takes place there, the type of statements that are made, we might as well be talking about, you know, the cowboy and Indian films. I mean, it's the same kind of invective. It's the same kind of us versus them. It's the other, that the great unwashed, you know, the savages that we have to kill. We have to kill savages all the time. You know, we characterize these people as savages. And yet we're the ones doing all the murdering.
Yeah.
So.
Plein de tes émotions, pleurant des larmes amères, surchargées de passion.
That was the first half of a 3-hour conversation with Peter Lavenda, the author. For more about Peter and his work, go to peterlavenda.com. You can hear the second half of this conversation at the same place on Wednesday, the 22nd of April. If you wish to support me and this podcast, The Liminalist, the podcast in between, you can sign on for regular donations at patreon.com/liminalist, or you can make a one-time donation at horticulture.wordpress.com. And thanks for listening as always. Without your ears to fill the forest, there would be no sound. Finalement, je suis sûr que